Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Q Commentator. My name's Nick Heath and thank you very much for joining me and joining me on this little journey through the art of commentary. I've been a broadcaster and commentator for about the last 10 years. The previous 10 years I was mainly employed as a bad actor. I was playing such roles as pub and club DJ, promotions and flyering guy in Waterloo Station, and 3 years in the role of office manager at my friend's estate agent. I did try and do broadcast journalism straight from school, but I had far too much fun in my A-levels and didn't get the grades. So I decided to slip through the back door, as it were, in my late 20s. And I've had a fantastic 10 years of commentating on the men's and women's games at the highest level in rugby, and a couple of other sports on the side as well. I've had the chance to go to a couple of Lions tours, Rugby World Cups and that sort of thing as well. So it's been a passion of mine that I'm delighted to be able to work in. But as a bit of a commentary geek, I've also always loved just the voices that go along with those big sporting moments that we remember, the moments and expressions that are synonymous with the rich sporting tapestry that makes up our lives, for all of you that are into sport as well, which is, I assume, why you'll be tuning into this podcast anyway. I'm delighted to say that the first guest that we have is, frankly, broadcasting royalty. Barry Davis left the army having gained some experience with Forces Radio. And then, well, the good fortune of the 1966 Football World Cup being on home soil in the UK is largely to blame, or is a great reason to celebrate how Barry's career started. Through football, tennis, the boat race, Barry retired at the age of 80 last year, having done his last Wimbledon commentary. And in the next 45, 50 minutes or so, we will discuss how Barry found his voice. We'll also discuss about knowing when to shut up, which is very important for all of us to remember, I think. Being unkind to Germans, and his thoughts on the modern co-commentator, which I think are quite interesting to hear given how those styles have very much changed over the last few years. So it's Q Commentator. Thanks very much for tuning in. Make sure you subscribe on whatever podcast platform you prefer. And it's Barry Davis, and I began by asking him why commentating appealed so much.
I think the answer to that is actually quite simple, because that is what was on offer. I had done some work when I was in the army, which led on to doing some work for BBC Sports Report. But the 66 World Cup came just at the right time. Well, not so much the fact that Cup came, but that it was in England.
Yeah.
Because had it been abroad, you probably wouldn't have been talking to me now. Almost certainly, because the opportunity which came would not have been there.
Did it take you a while to find your voice? You speak with a voice that seems absolutely synonymous with the broadcast voice. I know when I started, I, you know, with respect to you, was sort of by osmosis taking voices from you, from Brian Moore on ITV, and there seems to be this sort of slightly back of the throat sort of sound. And I sort of wondered whether that was something that it took you a while to find, whether that was always how you sounded in your youth. Tell me about whether that was an issue for you.
I think it was an issue because I was a tenor. And a tenor who gets excited can sometimes go off the scale.
Mm.
And I suspect when I started, well, I know because I've listened to some of the stuff, but not too often, because I would love to do various things again, lines that subsequently people came to remember from the early days of commentary. So the voice did develop, but I think it was only possibly age that developed it. I was advised by Sam Leach when I joined the BBC. He was then head of sport, that I should listen to and do everything that David Coleman did.
Hmm.
And his was a very strong voice.
Yeah, there's a danger of mimicry there, isn't there, as well?
Absolutely. My response to this piece of advice was I would listen to David and several other people who were around at the time, because this is now post the World Cup, and commentary had broadened.
Yeah,
I mean, when I first started, if you couldn't actually find a radio station to work for that was known to everybody, i.e. some BBC regions and things.
Yeah,
I mean, there was nothing like what there is now.
Yeah.
So your second best bet was probably hospital radio. Well, I mean, I started with British Forces Broadcasting, which was how that went. But yes, I actually said I'll listen to him and everybody else, but I want to fail as Barry Davis and not as somebody who sounded a bit like David Coleman.
And were you operating on the Coles lit mics all the time?
Yeah, very much so.
Because I often think that the reason you get a certain sound from commentators is often because although those devices are meant to sort of stop all the plosives coming through too much, actually it also means that you can sit off them a little bit vocally sometimes. The voice can sort of sit back a little bit further because you don't want to be too much on the front of your teeth. And so a lot of commentators, it's that sort of Steve Coogan does it with Alan Partridge, you know, well, I'm the sports commentator and the voice is right at the back of the throat. And,
yes.
And actually whether part of that is because of the apparatus that we use.
Yes, I don't know. I think that I'm just going back to David for a moment. He stayed with using a lip mic way after they were sort of being eased out.
Mm.
And when I took over his role of doing the Olympic opening ceremonies, I was amazed that he had still used the lip mic. I mean, I wanted some notes around, and I found on a trip to New Zealand, working for Television New Zealand prior to the World Cup of 1982, which their team qualified for.
Yeah.
And they took a lot of video of me working and so on and so forth, because I'd come from the gods, the
BBC.
They were
excited to have Barry Davis on there.
Yes. So I realised how much I used my hands anyway when I was talking.
Yeah, okay.
And at Wimbledon, I always worked with I don't know why they call it a head and breast set, but they do call it a head and breast set.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with the breast, as far as I can see, except that it just pokes in front of your mouth, or at least the side of your mouth to some degree.
Yeah.
But for football, quite a long time, we were on lip microphones.
Yeah. And would you warm up the voice ahead of doing a commentary?
Not excessively, no.
No.
I mean, there were always a few rehearsals of things.
Yeah, okay.
But I was not the world's greatest rehearser, is that the right word?
Warmer up.
The red light had to come on for me.
Yeah.
And quite often, if I rehearsed a line a bit too much, other than in my head, which I did quite a lot, It was not a good idea.
Well, I was going to come on to that, which I will in a minute. I mean, did you therefore have any moments where, you know, your voice let you down, or perhaps there were moments when, because I think maybe in the BBC documentary you sort of talked about a bit of a squeak on the voice on a couple of things, and I think we all have them. You can have moments that are that are full of great passion, but you know technically that you listen to it and go, I could have done that better.
Yes, I mean, there certainly were with the famous Leeds offside but not given goal against West Bromwich Albion. I mean, when I listen to that back now, I would love to do that piece of commentary again.
And funny, of course,
I mean, much was made in the documentary about the Francis Lee goal for Derby County against Manchester City, returning to his old club. I mean, on that occasion, the voice just went. I mean, I joked afterwards, I had the operation fairly soon after. It was all over. But people partly remember that for that.
Yeah.
But it annoyed me at the time.
Yeah, I've had one or two.
I was happy with myself, what I said, but I wasn't happy with how I said it. And as I said to Sue Barker in the biog, you know, it just proves that all the commentator has to do is to say the same thing twice and then again the same thing twice. So it was just two sentences repeated.
Yeah, indeed. And what about the prep then when you're going into these games? I mean, obviously, prepping for a tennis match, you've got two athletes to worry about. Mm. A football match, you've got potentially 22 and the replacement, the substitutes to worry about. So how much sort of prep would you do ahead of these things and how critical is it?
It's obviously critical, and I used to do a lot of preparation. And in the early days, I did too much,
right?
Because I had good lines that I wanted to get in, and I knew I was edited. And at some time, I was sort of searching to get a line in, which actually interrupted the flow of commentary, and I came to appreciate that.
When you say edited, do you mean for things like Match of the Day and that sort
of
thing?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the very best editors, if you made a general comment that editor thought was a significant line, they could move that line. That was all right.
Yeah.
But there was a danger that just after a goal, if you could find time to put that line in, that, and it still made sense, you had a better chance of getting it in.
Yeah.
but
did you ever do highlights commentary where you already had the footage, so therefore you knew you could craft the lines into the edit that had already been created? Because I've had to do
I've never had to do that.
Yeah, that's interesting because you can hear, you know, there's commentators I've worked with in rugby who you can hear that they've been staffed onto the commentary highlights that were already edited.
Yeah.
And it's the most perfect 3.5 minutes of commentary.
Yeah.
Because they've got all the lines and all the right stats in all the right places. And you're thinking, this guy's incredible. Before you then think, well, hold on a minute, nobody can be that good.
No. I had the test of commentating on the 100 metres that I couldn't see any pictures.
Yeah, that sounded incredible.
And that, you know, it was quite a test. But the key to it was that the producer, a guy called John Shrewsbury, insisted that it would be done straight away.
Yeah.
He said, you've got to do it now. Because he knew that if I stopped to think about it...
Yeah.
So it was almost sort of trying to flash the thing back through my mind again.
You're just going on instinct then, aren't you, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then doing the slow motion of something that I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
quite amusing looking back on it.
Yeah, I bet.
I thought that piece had got lost. It just turned up somewhere. And,
oh, wow.
And so they decided to use it.
Well, it scanned perfectly. And also so much of it is about that cadence. It's about the intensity, you know, hitting the right notes at the right moment.
Yeah.
And going back to sort of, you know, having those lines and people say, do you write down, you know, as a commentator, do you write down certain lines? And it might be that you know, certainly for me, I might write down half a stat or a thing, but it may be that a particular player who, I don't know, let's say it's England, France, and an English player has a French mother, that you know if he scores a goal, you need to come out with a line that summarises, you know, how things might be back at home that night or between his parents. So you might not script the line entirely, but you know that if a certain thing happens, you've got a certain line that you've got to get into a scenario.
And you hope you remember it.
Yeah.
I could think of many occasions. I mean, I used to think it was absolutely vital that you, the commentator, name the goal scorer before the ball actually crossed the line. I came to think that that actually wasn't the case, particularly if you're saying Jones, 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 yeah. which is what has happened quite often over the years. So I didn't write down lines at all. I had a few stats down, and I've always viewed that side of commentary as being looking at a program that you have at a match when you're watching it away from the microphone. You only look at the program when the match is not keeping your attention. I had a lot of stuff that probably never made the reel, but I moved from wanting to get a lot of things in to think upon it quite differently. And when you talk about usage of voice, I owe quite a lot to a chap called Jeff Goddard, who was the producer of a series called Maestro, which ran in the early 80s, and in which I took over that from Frank Keating. He used to write the script and do the interview, but they had an actor to read the script. I wanted to do all three. And Jeff was perfectly happy about that. But as a result, he was very harsh on things like cadence, emphasis, etc., etc. Okay. And he would make me do a six-word sentence six times and then six more times if he didn't think the balance was quite right.
Yeah.
He had a musical ear. He was one of the people who did the early elimination of Young Musician of the Year contestants.
Would you say you have a musical ear at all?
Yes, I'm more inclined to classical music to some extent. I mean, I used to sing in a choir once at school.
I think for most people, or my definition of a musical ear is having more of an in-tune understanding as to what your voice is capable of, hearing other things and being able to be not necessarily critical, but being able to appreciate the various nuances of a vocal performance. I think as a commentator, you have to be so aware of the notes you're hitting that I wonder if you can do it without a musical ear.
That's a very interesting point. I know that I always had my voice against the crowd. I had it wound up quite high in my cans, and would go to some lengths to get that balance right.
It was something Miles Harrison told me for my first ever game, or when I spoke to him a while ago. He said, "Make sure the crowd is as loud as you can have it in your cans, because it will take you there."
Yes. And I mean, there is a bit of a contest going on between you and the camera at the most exciting points. And I came off the register for Dennis Bergkamp scoring for Holland against Argentina. I mean, one of the amusing things about the documentary, which is not in any way a criticism of the work that was done and by quite a few people, but particularly by the producer Tom Butt, is that. Having the sort of observations made that I was somewhat laid back in comparison with John Motson. Indeed, he made that point.
Right, yeah.
The replays of great goals and things tended to be just as excitable as anybody else.
Yeah, I would say so.
But what was not necessarily there, other than the Maradona goal, the second one, some of the lines that came afterwards were not in the reel, because if they'd included those as well, it would have made it. Yeah,
it would have told a slightly different story. Yeah. Because you might have the lines that you prepare for certain sort of smaller incidents or whatever. When it comes to the big moments, you've got, you know, certainly something like tennis, you've got a potentially a match point, which signals you to be on standby, that you might be about to have to hit the big moment when it's a win, it's a game, set, match. Yeah. And then you've got to make sure, I mean, it's related to the whole thing of, well, on the highlights, I've got to get a certain thing in a certain way. But there's a pressure then that comes with knowing that this is the big moment. And were you always relaxed? Did it sort of take you years to be comfortable in yourself to know, well, it's about to be game, set, match to Pete Sampras or whoever, and I've got to summarise the scoreline, the performance, and get out for my co-com to then get his summary in before we wrap it up?
Yes, sometimes. I'm not sure that's entirely true at Wimbledon, because, things can be tightened up if needs be for highlights.
Yeah.
And there are times, and in particular in football, there are times when it's actually better not to say anything.
Yeah.
Take one example, the Koreans beating Italy in the 2002 World Cup, football obviously. And when the penalty decision was penalty competition decision was reached.
Yeah.
I didn't say anything over the last one because, I mean, there were just shots of these, everybody in red jumping up and down, and noise was huge. And later on that evening, the head of the Korean side of the World Cup said to me that, you know, he was really happy with that. He said, you didn't speak for about 45 seconds, maybe even a minute.
Yeah.
To which I replied, yes, I'm the world's greatest commentator when I keep my mouth shut. I do think it's important. I mean, it's very interesting. A friend of my wife's has been here. They've just gone off to lunch. And she said, are you doing lunch on your own? So I said, no, actually, I'm going to, chap's coming around to talk to me about commentary. And she immediately said, oh, tell him less is more.
Yeah.
And of course, that's been very much my principle.
Yeah, and I think beyond my first few years, I then have immediately started to learn that letting the pictures breathe and also not speaking unless you've got something to add to what the viewer can already see is a key lesson. But I think, you know, I think people, as they start, and I certainly did, you've got plenty to say. I'm the commentator. It's my voice along with the pictures. Yeah. I've got to keep going. I've got to keep saying. And actually, sitting back and letting it happen at times is absolutely right, isn't it?
Yes, I've gone on record in several places of saying that I think that one of the things that's produced the greater amount of talking is the fact that there's very little difference now between sound radio and television. And that's because the experts, Tuesday night, working for radio, Wednesday night working for television.
Yeah,
that's the tendency. There's also been a it seems to me, the thought that when something happens, you say very quickly, and then the expert comes in. I mean, Gary Neville comes in immediately. Andy Gray used to come in immediately.
Yeah. I sense frustration in your voice about this. I'm not sure you like it.
I don't like it. I don't like it. I mean, in terms of, I'm. This was always quite difficult because I was rather different on this line than John Motson, who I'm on record as saying tended to end a sentence with a variation of the word Trevor for Trevor Brooking.
Yeah.
And therefore, by indication, invited him to come in and say something.
Yeah.
And I could be accused of holding on to the microphone, as it were, because, I mean, when I started, there was only one microphone, and it was passed between the
two. Oh, really?
Yes. So, I mean, to get it off David Coleman was quite difficult, so people tell me, well, I was seeing for myself. But there is a balance, because the play-by-play commentators, they call them in the States.
Yeah.
He has to be there for the fan, can to some extent be there for the expert as well, has to sort of set his tone as he feels it. But when an incident happens, he knows what he's seen of it and what he hasn't seen of it.
Yeah.
Therefore, the first replay, he knows what to look for. And that, by taking that first replay, gives the expert an extra chance of saying something you know, a little different.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe he's already got that point, but I think it helps, but it doesn't happen very often these days.
No, it doesn't tend to. I had a moment where I wish I could have wrestled one microphone away, because I was on commentary in Rugby World Cup 2015 on South Africa, Japan in Brighton. Mm. And I called in on the radio, called in the try that won the game for Japan against all the odds, biggest upset in world rugby. And as I called the try, my COCOM just squealed all over it and started sort of saying what had happened. It's like, hold on a minute, I haven't rounded this moment off yet to bring you in. And I listen back to it now and I still have mates of mine go, who is that guy with you? I'm like, honestly, don't talk to me about it. It's like, that was possibly one of the biggest moments I had, and it screamed all over by my COCOM.
Yeah.
Not that I'm still bitter, obviously.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, I mean, it does, you know, when I go back to the Maradona goal, the two comments that I made after that, or indeed Gazza at Wembley for Spurs against Arsenal, I was allowed to do that. Nobody tried to interrupt in a live game.
Yeah.
There's still plenty of time. I know, I mean, the Americans, they get criticised for talking too much.
Mm.
But on points that really matter, you know, their ice hockey commentators, the best of them, will simply say, so-and-so, scored!
Yeah.
And then say nothing.
Mm.
And they cut around the crowd, the guy who made the mistake, the netminder who should have caught the puck, etc., etc., etc. And then they come in. But, of course, they control when the match restarts, and we haven't got that ability in our sports.
Yeah, I noticed listening to you know, certainly bits of that documentary and other things I've heard from you over the years, it seems that particularly in football, when goals are being scored, it was important to you, it sounded like, to say, you know, so-and-so, into the box, it's a goal, or he scored. And I wondered whether it was a sort of journalistic importance of yours to make sure that, because nowadays you get a lot of people, you know, you have the famed Aguero, and you've got all these other commentators nowadays who I don't think necessarily have told the viewer or the listener it is a goal, because they're either just calling the player's name several times. And I just wonder whether it was important to you to always make sure that you mentioned that was a goal or he scored before you said anything else.
You know, I don't think I know the answer to that.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, you said,
I mean,
you
know, sometimes, Jones... sometimes people have come up to me and said, oh, you weren't very excited about that goal, were you? I said, well, there wasn't anything to be excited about. my style, for good or ill, was I said what I felt. I mean, this has become a bit of a cliche of mine. And I hope that my foot was sufficiently far removed from my mouth. and sometimes, you know, regretted it. Certainly, would say to myself, if you can't think of what to say, don't say anything.
Mm.
And that's why I'm so critical of my commentary on the first of the Maradona goals in 1986, because I didn't see that the hand of the God, or the finger of the devil, as I subsequently called it.
Mm.
And because I didn't know what had happened, I should have left it until it became clear what had happened. It was a fair delay for decent replays. They cut replays in from London that they were advising me they're going up now, shortened, etc.
But I
suggested it might be offside, which was a ludicrous observation because it was a clearance by an England player that actually set up the opportunity. It came off the side of his boot. So in the law as it stood then, it would have been played on. And it was, you know, such a stupid thing to do. Keep your trap shut if you don't know.
Yeah. An interesting, you know, do you find many people who understand, given the reputation, the fantastic reputation that you've earned for yourself and, you know, recently retiring, do people understand that there are still these moments, these particular commentaries where you're still beating yourself up? It's like, come on, Barry, it's a long time ago. Look at all the great stuff you've gone. Yeah, but this still rankers. Yes, do people get that?
Yeah, people have said that. I mean, you always hope that you find the right words, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
You probably do. Well, depends on a good day and a bad day.
I mean, picking up. Obviously, I'm not going to go into depth on you know, a lot of your famous commentaries, but obviously, there's the one from GB Hockey in '88.
Yeah.
The where were the Germans, and frankly, who cares? It's a fantastic line. Is that? I almost wonder whether there's any reflection on it as to whether it almost comes across a bit unkind, maybe.
To the Germans,
yeah.
It does. I've spoken to a few German players. And indeed, when I subsequently was the commentator on Euro 96, you know, back to football.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the papers came out the day before saying, well, when they knew I was going to be the commentator, basically saying, well, the Germans won't get a word in sideways, which was, of course, it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but even so.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it was. And when I've been asked to sort of give chat-ins on what I feel about commentary, like now, it always comes back to haunt me that when I say that we come to the question of bias.
Yeah, okay.
And you could argue that was one of the most biased observations. But, I mean, the position, it was, I know that the sequence in my mind was having looked at it and wondered, you know, what on earth the Germans were doing because the Great Britain team went through the, like a knife through butter string,
yeah,
from the halfway line onwards.
Yeah.
And so I put forward that thought. Where were the Germans? And then I realised, you know,
it's
that's
another
the third
goal. Yeah, who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
Great Britain's going to win. So, and that's why...
It was your subconscious voice then almost that came through in commentary and perhaps, you know...
Yeah, well, I mean, I had no idea it was going to make quite the impression that it did make. I mean, they stuck it on a record and...
Yeah.
And frequently at hockey dues that I still get invited to with that team, and there's a what's it 40 30 years so there's a do on the 1st of October that the players are gathering together, and I've been invited to go along there.
How lovely.
And I know they will want me to,
of course,
to say that.
You better be rehearsing, make sure you can do it just as well as you did the first time. I mean, I've always, you know, very much the voice that I've always enjoyed from you has been during things like tennis commentary, because I don't know anyone that, you know, Dan Maskell to a degree, but who could, off the back of a 24 shot rally, finish it with oh,
yes.
And there are moments when I used to watch that growing up, and I just think that's it. That is all that's needed, because everybody in this room is agog at the fact that the final shot was the final shot, that you know these two athletes are slugging it out,
And
that very much is the less is more. And at times that you're effectively making a noise or a brief, you know, a brief word of awe that is sharing with the audience that from your privileged position in the commentary box, you're equally as blown away by what's happened. And it seems that sort of empathy with the viewer is something that I think you've always been good at.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. I mean, that is my sort of natural feel. I mean, Dan had a reputation for saying, oh, I say, which I confess I've said from time to time. In the early days, I became quite conscious I was possibly saying it too much when he was no longer around.
Mm.
But yeah, it's a reaction.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a reaction born of, what the hell can I add to that?
Yeah. I'm beginning to wonder whether this all of your best lines have been your subconscious going through, almost thinking in your head, oh, got nothing to add. Yeah. It came out. Oh, you said, where were the Germans? In your head, you thought, who cares? You said, frankly, who cares? Yes, we're going to discover the whole career has been your subconscious. Is there anyone that you wanted to emulate as you were commentating? Were there other people, your peers or others, and you thought that I've noticed he's doing that. I need to do a bit more of that. That kind of stuff. I mean, obviously, you started at a time where there weren't a huge number of people out there in the industry to look up to. But perhaps as you went through the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, into the 2000s,
stars have changed quite a lot over the years. When I joined the BBC, it was Kenneth Wolstenholme was the main football commentator and David Coleman was the main commentator across the board. I listened to them and, what as I said to you a few moments ago, it's the advice I would give to any would-be commentator. Listen to everybody, but do it your way.
Mm.
You might find doing it your way doesn't quite work sometimes, but you know, provided you don't get the sack for doing something that you shouldn't have done, then okay, you've learned the lesson.
Yeah. I spent the first, as I said, first 3 or 4 years of my commentary line, and I was a sort of COD commentator doing it in that very commentary voice, and then it took me a while to sort of bring the voice out to the front and actually start to own it as me and start to actually you know, it be my voice rather than this sort of COD voice that I'd been doing, you know, for impersonations or whatever for years, and I was almost struggling to find the real version.
One man's commentator is another man's irritation.
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting outlook.
You know, there were people who liked John Watson better than they liked me, and one or two the other way around. But that's something you have to accept. And commentary has changed as games have got quicker, athletes have got bigger, stronger. Life generally has got quicker. People talk far more quickly than I do. And when I came back after 10 years to do the game at Crystal Palace for the 50th anniversary of Match of the Day, I was well aware of that different speed.
Really?
Speed
of the game itself?
Speed of the game.
Yeah.
Still managed to spot a goal from quite early on. You win some and you lose some.
I was going
to say. It was a good day just to do one and get it right.
I've not lost it. Yeah. Go in with a 100% record.
That's right.
Upkeep it. I will come on actually just when we round off in a little while just to ask you actually about the sort of the commentary landscape.
Yeah.
Who do you rate out there now? Do you listen to other commentators? Who do you think's doing a decent job?
I think there are quite a lot of commentators. I sit on the fence a bit because I've talked to quite a few of them from time to time, and when people ask an opinion, when they ask for an opinion or whatever, I've given it to them. But I've never wanted to pick out a particular commentator because almost by implication you're putting that person above other people.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think certainly the BBC still have a very interesting choice of different commentators.
Do you think the BBC voice still stands separate from most of the rest?
I don't listen to as much as I or watch as much as I used to. I mean, I like John Murray on radio because he has a different style.
Yeah.
At one stage I thought he was going to come to television and offer that different style. How successful that would have been, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, because, I mean, there are my natural successor, if I'm entitled to say that I have one, was John Champion, who you know, has gone in different directions because of different people's opinions.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to accept that there's an editor or senior who says no, well I don't like him.
And actually on that point, you know, as a commentator these days, as a freelancer the likes of I am, you know, it'd be lovely to be with the BBC for 50 years or to be with any broadcaster. Now, we know that the rights change so often that it could be that you're this month's flavour of the month with a Sky or a BT or a BBC or what have you, or an Amazon or Facebook these days.
Yeah.
And you're on a 3-4 month deal as their lead guy, but 3 or 4 year deal. Yeah. But then the rights change hands in 4 years, and all of a sudden, you know, you're at the back of the queue looking for work with someone else.
Yes.
And you end up having to be best mates with the producers and the people that are making the decisions. And almost always, as I tend to find, there's no feedback as a commentator really in the industry. If someone says, oh, we've got a game next week, are you free for that one as well? That's as much validation as you get to the fact that you must have done a decent enough job.
Yes, and I think that's been true for a long time. I accept that there are many more commentators around because there are many more, the greater requirement for commentators at various levels.
Mm.
When I declined to stay with the BBC in 2004 or to stay with Match of the Day, I then, since 2004, have been freelance with quite a lot from the BBC, and some of which I knew I was getting, others came later. But I was actually asked if I would sort of have a few meetings with commentators to discuss. And I declined. I said I would love to do it, but I feel that I would be giving them advice which would be contrary to how things are going now, and therefore I wouldn't be helping them one little bit. In fact, I'd probably be shortening their careers.
Yeah, I mean, if you were starting out in the sort of landscape that there is now, would you have the appetite and energy for it, do you think?
Well, let's put it this way. When I was first offered what was going to become a regular job, which was after the World Cup of 66, when an opportunity came at ABC television, I was offered a 6-week contract, and I signed that and accepted and put in my resignation with the Times on the same day.
Right.
So I was taking a chance from that moment onwards.
Mm.
I have accepted that opportunities come and go, but I know that that's changed a lot now.
Mm.
But I could only ever do it in the way that I did it, and you know, could have been out of a job and quite early. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it sounds like that, you know, someone willing to take those risks, but backing yourself to take them, then perhaps, you know, you would survive in the modern marketplace. Certainly your talent would out anyway, but yeah, it seems...
Well, I would need to be given the opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, producers change, stars change, etc., etc.
Hmm.
I don't know how much the commentators of today feel that they have to do that particular way in order to satisfy the people they're working for.
Mm. And you get a lot of you get a lot of outlook now on, we've got a certain number of voices of this type. We need more regional voices, or we need, you know, different sounding things.
And yes,
there's more consideration.
There was a
now.
Time when the BBC were accused of having too many commentators who you couldn't just distinguish one from the other.
Yeah,
which I think was a bit of an exaggeration, but there were some similarities. Now that I think they've gone their own way to a degree.
Yeah. You said going your own way and doing your own thing would be a piece of advice you'd give to a modern commentator, anybody trying to get into it. Any other nuggets that you've learned over the years that you think are worth passing on?
The basic things are still the same. You have to do your preparation, and you have to be aware of the balance of yourself and who you're working with and so on and so forth. Some experts are easier to work with than others.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very conscious of... I think there's too much conversation in commentary now, but that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, I tend to share that view, actually.
That's one of the reasons why... it's the main reason why I left doing Match of the Day, because I felt I wasn't going to be given the opportunity that I wanted to suggest that my style was what people wanted.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've done games where you do suddenly find yourself having a chat about the sport as a whole and what's going on in it while there's a game going on in front of you.
Yes.
And actually, I've listened back to that and thought, do you know what? Although the game you're watching might not be the most exciting, it's not time to turn this into a magazine show. And there are still enough things going on the field that are worthy of you talking about rather than breaking off to discuss the politics of this or that.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there is definitely that has to be considered. You have to realise that you're talking to the person sitting in the armchair or whatever position they happen to be in at the pub listening. And that if you have a disagreement with the person you're working with, I think that can be no bad thing, provided you don't become two dogs with a bone, fighting over a bone, but you can have a different view. And it worries me sometimes when I feel that the commentator's not being given a chance to have his view.
Do you think a lead commentator, a play-by-play, is allowed an opinion, or is it just to call the action?
I think he's...
It's your personal view.
Yeah, my personal view is that he's allowed an opinion. I wouldn't have carried on doing it if I wasn't allowed an opinion. And I'd like to think that most would go along with that. But if you're going to push your opinions down people's throats for 90 minutes, that's a very different thing. But in a given situation, I think there are times when the commentator should commit himself and hope he's right. Winning boat races. Oxford did win. Could have been wrong. One stroke later, and it would have been Cambridge in 2003. But I felt there was a requirement then. It was to give an opinion because it was who the heck won this race.
Yeah.
So I suppose it could be described as an opinion. But I think commentators should be accepted as knowledgeable on the thing that they're doing. And with more experience, probably, than the footballer who's just joined the team that season, having retired before. It's a different job.
Yeah.
And that is, over the years, what television in particular has been guilty of, is assuming that you win a gold medal on Saturday and on Monday you're in the commentary box.
Yeah.
As you learned your first career with a lot of good coaching and so on and so forth, why shouldn't you think that you need to be coached for the second career? And I used to find working with people, a lot of people, we did have conversations like this off the record to give a few views and to assist.
Yeah. Yeah. There certainly is a bit of that. And you have some that turn up and bring their homework with them, and you know that they understand it's a job to prepare for, and you have others that walk off the pitch almost with boots in hand and think they can pick up the microphone.
Yes.
And surprise, surprise, they end up with very little of interest to us.
Yeah.
There are
some like that. I hope they wouldn't survive too long. But I mean, there's also another thing that has tended to be lost over the years is that, I mean, we used to have lots of information about pronunciation of foreign names, and now most of those names are anglicised, it seems to me.
Yeah, there is a fair bit of that. I think, because it's got to be one of the first jobs as a commentator is to get the ID right of the player involved. But if you're going to be doing that, then you've got to have his name correct or her name correct.
Yes, I mean, I think if he's going to score the greatest goal of his life, and you call him a different name, or what sounds a different name, I don't think whether he would be capable of suing you, but maybe.
Wouldn't be too happy.
No.
Well, Barry, we've just got a couple of minutes left. Miles Harrison, the rugby commentator on Sky, who used to do football as well, he once told me that he can be guilty of commentating on almost anything in his life at any one minute. He did say, according to his wife, which he tempered, as he said, have school sports days or family games of Monopoly in the Davis household been accompanied by Barry's dulcet tones?
Yes, if I'm truthful.
Yeah, brilliant. That's what I wanted to hear.
Yes. But sometimes I have competition these days. I mean, both my children are involved in sport of one sort or another, and they have quite good opinions. My wife is not one to be left out, so...
She's saying less is more, as we know. We touched on it a little bit earlier. You're a man that's seen a lot of the sporting landscape as a commentator for over 50 years. Do you think that the coverage now is better on all fronts, or do you think that things have moved so fast that some of the more, I don't know, intimate elements of the art of sports reporting, coverage, commentary have been lost in the race to sort of make sure that everything's being covered all of the time?
Crikey, what a question. I mean, from the point of view of pictures, I mean, I refer to somebody sitting in an armchair. I mean, you're actually sitting in an armchair, standing up, lying down, for all the different angles. That's what I'm suggesting that you get now. Mm. You're never in the same seat. You're moved around the ground.
Yeah.
I think it's possible that it is a. I mean, television is about picture, so that is the first requirement.
Mm.
And I don't think commentary should compete against those pictures. To add to the pictures, because you're getting so many angles, is quite difficult to say something that is not obvious to the viewer. And it's possible that that's become more difficult than it was.
Mm.
I mean, certainly in the days of working with four cameras and so on and so forth. But in the early days, producers talked more to the commentator.
Yeah.
I find now that producers don't talk as much to the commentator. In my day,
how does that affect it, do you think?
Well, I liked to feel that we're all part of a team.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't sure who made the pass that actually proved to be crucial, and I would sort of press the lazy button and said, who the hell was it that played the...
Yeah.
And if the, you know, one of the low cameramen came up with a name and I used it and it was wrong, that's my fault.
Yeah.
But I was very happy to, because most of the cameramen, the good cameramen, know the game that they're doing.
Yeah.
I felt that it... I just felt... You know, I'm nosy. If I'm at an OB on one sport, in the days of grandstand, I would quite happily listen to quite a lot of what was being said away from my sport before they came to me, while still doing the commentary on whatever it was I was supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
It was a different at Wimbledon this year, because Wimbledon are now producing rather differently. It was totally the BBC before.
Yeah,
for
okay.
This year. I mean, I would often listen to Sue's long introduction rather than the short introduction.
Yeah.
Just to see what she said, what's going on.
What's the flavour of the day?
Yeah. Nosy.
Yeah.
So nosy yeah. And greedy. There you are.
what other adjectives would you use to describe yourself with? We've got nosy and greedy. You've got five other dwarves to select.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate that I've been paid for a hobby. I would like to have played sports better.
Would you?
When I do occasionally. I mean, one of my friends says that my service in tennis is when it works, the most professional of anybody that we play with. At a very low level, I'm talking about. Yeah. But I would rather have a consistent serve that worked. But yeah, I mean, there's a summary in one of these Who's Who or whatever.
Mm.
And among interests, I've put all sports, sadly, enthusiasm way ahead of talent.
Yeah, and that enthusiasm is what's brought that enthusiasm to many people over the years. You mentioned talking to the person in the armchair. I've always had a view that part of the commentator's job is the fact that that person in the armchair on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon might have a newspaper in front of them. They're catching up on what's going on. And your job at times during when it gets exciting is to make them lower that newspaper. And it'll be through the accuracy and through the voice that you find in order to make sure that they sort of pick their head up and take note of the key bits. Do you think that sort of works as an analogy?
I think that's a very, very, very good analogy. I mean, put slightly more simply, I've felt that the moments that bring the viewer and the armchair to the edge of the seat, you need to respond. I remember a headline written about something I'd done a long, long time ago in the Daily Mail, which the headline was, "When Barry says, ooh, he says it for all of us." And there's an element of truth in that. You know, they probably don't... poor old Gareth Southgate's miss in the... I mean, I just said, oh, no.
Yeah.
That's what occurred to me to say, and then I didn't say anything for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I would guarantee that most viewers said exactly that, probably flavoured by a few words around the oh no, that I would be in trouble with if I'd used them on air. But that was just, you know, that was just my gut instinct, particularly having felt that there was something wrong about the run-up to take it.
Yeah.
It although it came as a surprise, it had to come as a surprise.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that there's one commentator around who actually said that he didn't fancy it beforehand, which made him a clever what's it. But in the atmosphere of the time, probably didn't endear himself to other people.
It's not what people want to hear, is it, necessarily?
No. But I think a lot of commentators can pick, football observers can pick the one that's going to miss.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
Reasonably often.
Yeah. Well, Barry, I hope I can find you playing tennis at some point to find out if you're commentating on your own serve. That would be an absolute treat. No consistency again.
Yeah. Keep the arm straight, do throw it up high, get the toss high enough. Yeah.
It's been a treat to spend time with you. Thank you so much for your time and enjoy retirement.
Thank you.
The fabulous Barry Davis there. What an absolute treat. And, the chance to share a little chuckle with him towards the end. I was beaming for several days after that moment. Absolutely brilliant opportunity to chat with the great man. And I hope you found that entertaining and interesting. And there'll be another one along next week, all to be revealed. But in the meantime, do make sure you subscribe. My thanks to the guys at Acast. You can subscribe via iTunes and Spotify as well. And keep in touch with us on Twitter. Let me know your thoughts at Q Commentator. I'm very, very grateful for your listen and hope to be back next time. This has been a Rugby Media produced production. I'm Nick Heath, and I'll see you again soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.